Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Drivers are more likely to cause crashes in the first few months after they earn a driver's license. In Ohio last year, more than 130 people between the ages of 16 and 25 died in a crash. Another 17,000 were injured in crashes during that same period. Now the state is turning to virtual driving terminals in a 14-month pilot project to both train new drivers and gather data for training curriculums. Dr. Flora Winston is the founder and scientific director of the Center for Injury Research and Prevention. She's director of the Center for Child Injury Prevention Studies at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is partnering with the state. Dr. Winston is overseeing the research. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Winston.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Does that kind of play out across the country, sort of those same rates?
It sure does. One of the little secrets that families don't know is that the leading cause of death for adolescents in this country is motor vehicle crashes. If you look at why teens die, 1 in 3, it's because of a motor vehicle crash. And those first months after getting an independent license, those are the most critical. The highest rates of crashes occur for your lifetime during that period of time.
Is that just because they don't have mom or dad in the front seat with them smashing their foot on the floor, or what?
Well, what we've learned is that in those first months is that they don't know how to drive. They haven't had sufficient training, skills, experience that can give them the safe driving skills to avoid common crashes.
I took driver's training 100 years ago. Why isn't it enough anymore?
Well, actually, it never was enough. Okay. Driver training never was enough. You always needed the parents to practice with you in lots of diverse settings. You know, when you think about it, how long does it take someone to learn how to play a musical instrument, football, any other skill that requires a lot of coordination, higher level thinking? It takes you thousands of hours. And what we do is we think this really critical skill can be taught with 6 hours behind the wheel and maybe 50 hours on the road. So I think that the teens are just not getting the skills and experience training that they need when they're learners before they go out on the road. But this is true of every driver. Even if they're older, those first months are the most risky for them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and I'm talking with Dr. Flora Winston. She's founder and scientific director at the Center for Injury Research and Prevention and director of the Center for Child Injury Prevention Studies at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is partnering with the state of Ohio to employ virtual driving terminals in a 14-month pilot project to train new drivers and also gather data for training curriculums. Take me into one of these virtual driving terminals, Dr. Winston, and tell me how it works.
Well, what you'll see when you come up is like I've been at Morse Road and other places. It looks like basically a laptop and headphones and a monitor with a steering wheel, brake, and pedal, something very simple. But really what's happening there is you're being immersed into a driving route that has been carefully chosen to identify to put you in the place of the most common serious crash scenarios. We developed the route in partnership with subject matter experts in Ohio in the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. And so it's actually an assessment. Think of it like you're just measuring the temperature of whether or not this new driver, or any driver, has the skills to avoid the most common serious crash scenarios. You can't do that on the road because it's too dangerous, right? So what we do is we just put it into the simulator, and within 11 minutes, you get through this whole assessment, and at the end, you have a better sense of what you're prepared to do and what you're not prepared to do and what things you might need to work on with an instructor or with your parent or with another adult.
So you do this before you even start the class then?
Well, that's not how we've done it yet.
Okay.
That's something that we're planning on doing. What we've done over the 14 months that the pilot just ended is that we had in five different testing centers in near Columbus, but also Zanesville and Springfield, there were these kiosk setups, the simple hardware that I talked about, had the virtual driving test software, the virtual driving assessment software on those computers. And before someone went for an on-road exam, they were given the opportunity to actually look at their skills, see how well they could perform. And because we were doing this as a pilot, it had no effect at all on whether or not they passed or failed their on-road exam. The results were never given to the state and to the evaluator. But the person could opt in to get an email with information about how they did. And so, you know, it was amazing. We had no problems where people were very upset about it. It would fit in the workflow really well. People really downloaded that information when they went home. But the most important part of all of this is that we were able to link our information that we got from this assessment to whether or not people passed or failed their on-road exam. And what we found is that this assessment accurately predicted 8 out of 10 applicants' on-road test results. And less than 1 in 100 who failed the virtual driving assessment went on to pass the on-road exam. And so I think that it really was a very good indication of how well they were prepared for the on-road exam and they were prepared for the skills. Because if you were predicted to fail based on the virtual driving assessment, you were 4 times more likely to fail the on-road exam. So that's how it worked. So you come in, you just go to one of the kiosks, do this virtual driving test that's completely self-guided, and you're on your own. And then when you're done, they went on for their on-road exam. We got all that data and compared the two, and people got, you know, an assessment and a report at home that could tell them how to be safer drivers.
How many altogether participated in the pilot?
Well, it was really quite amazing how many. We had initially, I think it was 4,000. Let me see what the number was. We had over 4,000 in the initial pilot. But since that time, we've continued to flow. And so it's actually been now 40,000 have gone through this test. And the results are really holding up. We're really pretty excited. So for the report that we just released, we actually did the analyses on 20,000. So lots and lots of people have gone through this of all different ages, people who've had preparation before their on-road exam, people who haven't, and we're very happy with the results because it really is giving us a sense of who's prepared to drive safely and who's not and how people can improve, what skills people are bringing and what skills they might be lacking.
Besides the pass or fail of the virtual driver's test, how much do you know about the people who have opted into this?
Almost everyone did. We have very, very few people who did not complete this. Almost everybody did because it really, it was like under, like around 6% of the people did not do it, like and or did not complete it. So as much less actually didn't do it at all. The people who didn't complete it, it was for multiple reasons. Sometimes it was just that, it's time for your on-road exam. Got to stop coming over with us. Or someone decided not to go for the test for some reason. There were almost no reasons for people to stop it because they didn't want to. So the main reasons for not completing the test, they couldn't really get used to the simulator, which was really only 1% of the people. They didn't complete the entire workflow. It was only 6%. And some of the people it was inconvenient that day. And so, you know, that happens all the time that people just can leave.
So even though it was opt-in statistically, you feel really comfortable with the results?
Oh, yeah.
Because so many opted in.
Yeah, 94% of the people did it. And, you know, when we start looking at the kinds of things people did on this drive, so, for example, things like improper steering, erratic swerving. 11% of the people who went on to fail had that, but only 2% of the people who passed. Things like not coming to a complete stop at a stop sign. All these kinds of things. Failing to scan well. Driving through red traffic lights. Colliding with a vehicle or a pedestrian in the simulator. that was, you know, these were all highly predictive of who was going to go on to fail the on-road exam. So it gave us even more confidence because the kinds of things that the people were doing wrong were the kinds of things you don't want somebody to do wrong when they're driving alone.
What, you mentioned the common crash scenarios for young drivers. Is that city specific? Is that what you mean by that? Or are there common crash scenarios for young people across the board that we know about?
It was from national data, and it's across the board. And when I tell them to you, you'll say, yep, I know somebody who had that crash. Mm-hmm. So going straight where the other vehicle stopped and they hit a rear end. So, like, you know, you're following too closely, not scanning. I mean, how many young drivers do that, unfortunately? Stopped in a traffic lane, turning left at an intersection and crossing traffic, and they collide with a vehicle that's in their path. Negotiating a curve but not realizing it's a curve, so they go off the side of the road. These are all things, nothing's really gotcha. These are things that good, experienced, qualified drivers really know how to do. And one of the cool things about the drive is that if you drive our virtual driving assessment, I encourage you to go. It's right there in Columbus. If you go and do it, if you're a good driver and you're an experienced driver, you don't even notice that anything's going on because it just feels like regular driving. Mm-hmm. But when somebody who's an inexperienced or unskilled driver goes through it, they really, are challenged. And I'd much rather see that in a simulator than on the road.
Is there any way to simulate distractions?
Yep, we do that as well. It's not something that is explicitly related to the drive that we have in Ohio, because that wasn't what was required. But, you know, in terms of distractions, you can ask people to follow signs. They can we can watch their eyes and what they're looking at on the road when they're looking at the instructions. There's so many ways you can do that in a simulator to look at distraction. And we've even done things where pretend phone calls you. So there's just so much we can do. And what we're seeing is this is an assessment system, very, very different from the way the simulators have been used elsewhere. This is just a virtual driving assessment. So we can put things in there and give you a sense of what you do well and what you don't do well and help you get through it.
How have the simulators been used elsewhere?
Most of the ones have been used, simulators are used for trainings to some degree, and that's not what this is about. It's not about training anybody. It's a very short assessment. It's to really, like, look at, can you do this? Can you do this? Can you do this? And if you can't, here's what you need to do in practice. Here, you might need to go and get more training. Mm-hmm. You might not be ready for the driving test yet. You should rethink that, whatever it might be. I think there are other ways to get training. I personally think the best way to get training is to be on the road and to be with an instructor or to be with a parent who's following an instructor's advice on how to best train. We also have resources for families that can help them. It's called teendrivingplan.org that gives them really detailed information about how to handle intersections and lots of other things with videos. So I really think you have to be on the road to test these.
Do you I guess I kind of know what I think you're going to, how you're going to answer this, but I'll ask it anyways. Do you see a time when virtual driving will be a testing, not just a gauging?
You know, it's interesting, testing versus gauging.
Yeah.
Right now, I really look at this as a tool to help people be safer drivers. And that's the way that Ohio is seeing it. What Governor DeWine just announced last, when we were in the press conference a few weeks ago, is that he wants these to be in all the driving schools across the state, as well as in the BMVs. And for right now, the way we see it is that this is a tool to help drivers be safer. We don't, you know, the worst day for a family is for any family is to have a beautiful young child who just didn't know how to drive and they come home with a crash or worse yet, injured or dead. And so this is really a major public health issue. It's a major issue for families. And I think that this is really mostly for right now, it's a tool. And what people can use is that they can use this to predict what someone might do right or wrong and prevent this tragedy from ever happening. Whether it's going to be used for training, that's up to legislators. You know, not for training, for testing,
for
evaluating, that's up to the legislators. Yeah.
And do you see a day when we move into, for the reasons you endorse it for, into actual virtual reality?
You know, virtual reality meaning like a headset?
Yeah.
You know, at this point, I personally am not in favor of that. We thought about it because people get simulator sickness with the headsets, and they're also very costly. Our goal was to get this to as many people as possible and to get it to as many sites, as many schools. I think 350 schools are going to be able to apply to get the hardware for free, but any other school that wants to do it, they're going to have the license to do it as well, and we just wanted to keep it very low cost. If I saw that we weren't getting such fabulous results, then we would have to make it more and more complex. Mm. But one of the problems with simulators is for it to be really, really accurate, it's very expensive. You know, with the base moving and this and that. Mm-hmm. And we said, nope, we're going a different way. We're going to make it the least expensive hardware, and what we're going to have is the best software, the really valid software that's immersive, and everybody gets the same experience. And let's just leave the fancy doodads to somebody else.
Dr. Flora Winston, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. And please tell everybody to drive safely for the holidays and work with your teen over the holidays.
Dr. Flora Winston is the founder and scientific director of the Center for Injury Research and Prevention and director of the Center for Child Injury Prevention Studies, pardon me, at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which has collaborated with the state of Ohio to put virtual driving terminals in BMVs and driving schools around the state in the future. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Finding time to read can be a challenge. Audiobooks can help with that. Audiophile Magazine recently released its best audiobooks of 2019. We'll post a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Robin Witten is the editor and founder of Audiophile Magazine. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Ann. Glad to be here.
Robin, what makes a good audiobook?
Well, in a few words, it's the storytelling. You need to have your storyteller take you wherever the author wanted, whether it's straight-up information, a crazy story, a comfortable romance, whatever it is. That makes a great audiobook, a great listening experience.
I remember when my son was young, we would listen to the Harry Potter audiobooks in the car when we were commuting, and the guy who did those was phenomenal. It was just one person. A lot of the best audiobooks of 2019 that I see have multiple narrators.
Yes, well, we do have quite a lot of exciting audiobook titles in the list that are multiple narrators, either as a cast or as an ensemble. Some of them are short stories, so there's actually one narrator for each story. Some of them are more of a cast where there are lots of different voices of the characters. And then there are some of the narrators who just do all the voices, like Jim Dale did in Harry Potter.
Yeah, I think he won an Emmy for it, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm sorry,
a Grammy Award.
Right.
Yeah, a Grammy Award. How has audiobook technology changed over time?
Well, I think the most exciting thing for listeners and the technology of audiobooks is they go everywhere with you because so many people use their phones to listen. And it used to be, you know, you'd be circling the block because you wanted to get to the end of the you wanted to get to the end of that chapter. Or so now you, if you've got your phone, you can pick up and go with it, whether it's walking the dog, cooking, you know, doing an errand, or commuting to work. The books go with you everywhere.
How long have they been around?
Oh, I think they pretty well. If we go back, I'd say maybe the mid '80s, where as cassettes were available somewhat. They were being collected by libraries. I mean, libraries have done an amazing job of making this format so available to listeners, and always have been a huge advocate of audiobooks, even as the technology changed from cassette to CD and now to streaming e-audio.
Right. Do some kinds of books lend themselves, or maybe another way to ask that is, are some kinds of books not well suited for audio?
I think occasionally that happens. I mean, the publishers are fairly astute if there's something like an audiobook that has maps or diagrams or a lot of reference material, sometimes there'll be a PDF document that is available along so you can reference it. But, you know, there are so many things that do lend themselves to audiobooks and as a listening experience. For many people, it's a great way to read and take in information of all kinds.
Hmm. You know, one of the things that I like about a book is that I can write in it, which is terrible, but that's what I do. But then, which is one reason why e-readers, even though I've tried a couple different kinds of them, I never quite get into them because I can't write in them. I know you can take notes in them, but it's not the same thing.
Right. And
maybe audiobooks are the same way, but they're great for travel. How much does a person's voice, the narrator's voice, factor into this?
Oh, it makes all the difference. I mean, that's really, audiophile is so focused on celebrating the match of a narrator with the book, with the author's work. When it works, it is like a magic and makes a fantastic listening experience. And so those are the books that rise to the top and get on our best of the year lists, where there is this very special connection between your storyteller and the book that you're reading.
That was that Jim Dale experience for me. Now, yeah. I think even when I read the Harry Potter books, I always hear Jim Dale's voice.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes authors will say that, like Janet Ivanovich, there are several others will say, I hear the narrator who over many, many titles in a series have narrated an author's work.
And it influences them probably a little bit.
To a certain extent, and sometimes they insert little tricks for the narrator to have to deal with. I think that's kind of fun.
We are talking about audiobooks today with the editor and founder of Audiophile Magazine, Robin Witten. Audiophile Magazine recently released its best audiobooks of 2019. We'll post a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Robin Witten, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How do you put the list together? How do you make these decisions?
Well, Audiophile, over the course of a year, reviews and recommends. Well, we review almost 2,500 audiobooks with a group of almost 100 reviewers all across the country, and we're looking for the best ones. So from the ones that are celebrated in the magazine and on our website with what we call Earphones Awards, we then look at trying to take that list down to maybe 5 or 6 in about 8-9 subject categories. So that's very hard, but we think that the titles that are uniquely audio, where there's something that you would not get from the print edition. Those are the titles that we want on the best of the year list.
And so give me an example of that and how that's achieved. Say one of your books this year was The Testaments by Margaret Atwood.
Absolutely.
What made that a standout for you?
Well, at the very start, the main narrator of The Testaments is Anne Dowd, who plays Aunt Lydia in the streaming series.
Oh, my gosh. It's the same actress who plays Aunt Lydia.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yes. So suddenly the story is being told to you by Aunt Lydia, which is you can't get that off the printed page. And there are other narrators in the performance of The Testaments as well. But
that's really interesting, because I watched the Handmaid's Tale religiously.
Right.
And so when Anne Dowd is reading it, is she reading the part of Aunt Lydia?
No, she is. She's the main narrator of
okay.
The Testament.
All right.
So, you know, she is not just playing a simple role in it. But it's, you know, quite an experience. We also have on our list An American Sunrise, which is Joy Harjo's latest collection of poems, our poet laureate.
Huh.
Now, of course, for years, we've always, you know, accepted that poets should read their own work for the most part. But, and yet there are books of poetry, but to hear her express amazing emotional and very personal expression of her poems is something that, you know, you can't get any other way. It makes a very special kind of listening experience, but also archival and useful for students, and creates something that has such lasting value.
Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson is another of the selections, and it's narrated in part by Jacqueline Woodson, but she also has characters reading the parts. And I've met her and I've interviewed her and I've heard her read her work before, and I can see that she would be really good at it.
She is. She's one of the authors who does a spectacular job with her own work, and yet she also, I think, enjoys having other voices brought in to either, you know, something like this, which is adult fiction, or some of her children's and teen titles.
How much do the authors have control over this?
Well, I think sometimes it depends on how interested they are.
Mm-hmm.
Some authors are very interested. I think Jacqueline Woodson is very interested in the narrators, and I think they often get to hear samples from actors who are being considered by the publishers for the roles. So they can be very involved.
You know, if you look at The Testaments by Margaret Atwood, you know, Anne Dowd, as you mentioned, she's a phenomenal actress. She was also in The Leftovers. Bryce Dallas Howard, a very famous actress. How interested are they in reading, doing audiobooks?
Well, I think sometimes they have a chance to do a really important title. Like The Testaments,
mm-hmm.
They're going to jump at the chance. Actors, I think, who have had long careers in film and television, I mean, Jason Culp is one of those who reads Akin by Emma Donoghue. You know, he has found that in the last decade or so of his career, he's been fascinated by the narration of audiobooks. And, you know, it's another dimension for an actor's career. that is, you know, some of them didn't think about. Some of them are still, you know, very busy with other types of dramatic presentations, whether it's live theater or movies. But some of them really love the idea of the storytelling. And I have to say, they like to play all the parts.
Right. How big are audiobooks now? I mean, I can't imagine that once it went digital, it didn't explode.
Oh, it has. The audiobook industry has had over the last more than 5 years, they've had double-digit growth in sales and in the number of audiobooks that are being published. So, you know, it's a darling of the publishing industry, doing very well, continuing to grow strongly and attract, interestingly, a younger demographic than you might think.
How so?
Well, I think that at least more than 50% of the population that is listening to audiobooks is under the age of 45.
Wow. I suppose that tracks maybe the interest in podcasts as well.
I think it does, and I think also we have to give credit back to Harry Potter and Jim Dale, because all of those kids who were listening have a great affinity for listening to the stories they're interested in and also for taking in a lot of information.
Are there critics, people who say if you listen, you don't get the same thing out of it as when you read it?
I think there usually are. You know, some people, it's a learning style. Some people are better listeners than others. Some people can take in information more fluently when they hear it than when they're reading it in text.
And when you're driving, it's much safer.
Quite a bit safer, yes, indeed. And as I said, it's the portability of audiobooks is one of their great aspects. And you know, as we go into the holidays, they make great gifts.
How do you do that? You just give somebody.
You can give credits for an audiobook through an audio account. Where you're getting your digital audiobooks. You know, CDs still are available if you've got a vehicle that plays them or someone wants those.
Yeah.
And, of course, the library is there's not, you know, they are the greatest gift to all of us because
they
the
sure
audiobooks are.
Are
right there.
Right. Well, Robin Whitten, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne.
Robin Whitten is the editor and founder of Audiophile Magazine. They recently released its best audiobooks of 2019. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have a little bit more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley. We're continuing our march to Christmas and gift giving when it comes to tech. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley puts together a gift guide for Tech Tuesday listeners every year. Today we're talking about ideas for kids, those under 12. Russell Holley joins us now. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Let's see. For children under 12, you are recommending, first of all, what makes a good tech toy for a kid under 12?
I think really the thing that makes a tech toy useful for anyone under 12 is being able to use it without, not necessarily without parental supervision, but without parental involvement. Like have a parent be able to set something up and say, okay, this is now something that you can use safely. So it's not, you know, connecting them to the internet. It's not taking their data away. It's not, doing anything like that. It's something that they can have fun with. without having to worry about any kind of extra steps.
A lot of times when we talk about little kids, we talk about educational stuff. Is that the case necessarily with the under 12 crowd, you know, that kind of in between, the tweeners, I guess?
Absolutely. One of the coolest things about the under 12 audience is that there's a lot of things educational, especially when it comes to like introduction to programming.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually two of the recommendations that I have today are geared specifically towards that audience to kind of get them thinking about, you know, how to think about programming. And the first one is actually it's from the people who make the Kano computer, which we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of kind of an isolated computer that teaches them everything about, you know, computing and programming, this is just focused on the programming aspect. And it does it by looping in either your choice of Star Wars or Frozen, depending on which thing your kid is interested in.
Good picks for Kano. It's, you know, I mean, Frozen 2 is in the theaters right now. Star Wars is going to be, right?
That's right. Yeah, those are two things that are going to make a lot of sense for getting people's attention for the holiday season. And both of them follow the same basic idea. You have a little hockey puck shaped thing that comes in the box that plugs into either a computer or a tablet and gives this program that goes through the introductions of programming, and it does it by making it super interactive. That puck is actually a sensor for the child's hand and uses the programming techniques to create the illusion of either, you know, using the force by kind of moving your hand over the pad or using snow magic in the case of Frozen.
Snow magic. These are stories for coding. So you're learning while you're listening to a story, you're watching a story unfold, right?
Right. The idea is that you're presented with problems that are, you know, in line with what you've seen from these stories, and you have to, you know, create a programming technique to solve those problems. So, if, you know, using the force, you need to move a couple of boxes out of the way in order to get through a doorway. You would write, you know, what to do when your hand is over the pad and what to do when your hand makes the shape of a fist and things like that. And then you see the interactive part of it when you actually go and get to do that based on the program you've created in order to you know, make it look like you're using the force on the screen.
Coding is such an obvious thing to teach kids. They think it's fun, right?
Right. The idea is that it's presented in a way that it is very simple kind of individual problem solving technique. It's very rarely presented in the form of, you know, write this program so much as use these puzzle blocks to solve a problem. And so that's kind of a big fundamental thing about how to teach kids to program at a young age, is that it's not so much memorizing the lines of code that need to be used so much as how to think about solving a problem. You know, the kind of steps that you would need to go through in order to you know, create a simple machine to do something is a big part of how Kano functions with a lot of its tech. And I really appreciate that as both a parent and as someone who, you know, kind of understands how frustrating it can be to teach someone to program through memorization.
So how much do these programming kits cost?
You can get either of these programming kits right now from Amazon, starting at $50. On sale right now. They usually start at around $80, but through some of the stuff that's left over from Cyber Monday, you can get them for $50 for either one of these. They don't currently have a bundle for both of them if you happen to have, you know, multiple people in your life who would be interested in this, but you can easily pick up one or the other, and they are very interchangeable, just depending on the software you want.
What kind of hardware do you need?
You can connect this to an iPad. You can connect this to an Amazon tablet or an Android tablet. If you have a Windows machine, you can connect it to this. The Kano people have worked pretty hard to make it so that it works with just about anything with a screen.
Cool. You wanted to talk about Sphero Spark Plus Programming Ball. What is
it? This is super cool. The Sphero people have, for a long time, had this remote control ball that you could drive around. And the coolest thing about it, you know, 4 years ago when the first one came out, was that if you had too much money and a phone, you could annoy the crap out of your cat by driving this thing around and kind of running into it and driving it insane. But they actually found a lot of education centers across the U.S. to work with in order to teach kids the fundamentals of programming using this toy. So you can teach it route mapping and, you know, kind of basic, you know, patrols and instructions. And this is less about staring at a screen and more about programming something that actually goes and does something. So you can, you know, you can teach this robot ball to you know, draw the perimeter of your room, or to go to one point in your room and come back multiple times. You can repeat that. And as you're building those same kind of puzzle style building blocks inside of this app, you get to then actually see this robot go and do those things in front of you.
So you're learning and playing with this toy.
Right. You're learning and playing. There's a lot of different options for how you have fun with this. And I've seen this actually deployed in classrooms before. And one of the really cool things that I've seen done with it is actually taking just a glob of paint on the ground, across a big canvas, and letting the kids teach the robot how to draw specific shapes. And as it runs through the paint, it draws all over this canvas, which ended up being just this visually very cool thing and helped, it wasn't just programming. It was this piece of art that they could then hang up at the end of the classroom.
Oh, neat. Is it expensive?
These started about $100, and there are a couple of different versions. The kind of standard little ball is this clear ball that you can get is $100. But then they also, if you want something that's a little more functional for kind of long-term driving and things like that, they actually make a four-wheeled car that they call Rover, and that is $250. The difference that you get here is just a lot more flexibility as far as, where it can go and what it can do and what it can connect to. One of the cool things about Rover is, as kind of an advanced programming thing, is you can actually turn it into a weather station. The idea is to kind of teach kids to think about how they would design for something that was going to be like a Mars rover, where you can kind of add extra pieces of hardware to it in order to make it more useful. So that's obviously for something that's a little more advanced than a 12-year-old, but the good starting point is this Spark Plus device.
Yeah, and are you thinking about the programming ball with older tweeners, like the 9, 10, 11 set, or how young could you go?
You could definitely go as young as 6. You know, the app makes it really easy to do the same kind of puzzle style, problem solving. You can look and say, I want it to go forward, I want it to turn left, I want it to come back. As kind of a starting ground, and then it will continue to become more complicated as they start to think about things a little differently. So you could definitely start younger, but the app works for a pretty wide age range.
Okay, cool. The CoolPad Dino Watch, I think you've talked about this before. You really liked it.
I have. Yep, this is still my favorite smartwatch for kids in that it doesn't require connection to a phone. It doesn't, it has a bunch of safety features that are great for parents. It actually has its own cellular network built into it. So if your kid is somewhere and needs to reach you, can very easily do it from this watch in a safe way, and can kind of share information with you. It also has geofencing software built into it, which means if your child is in an area that is not where you think they are supposed to be, you actually get a notification on your phone that says, hey, this watch is not where you think it's supposed to be right now. So if your kid is, taken from school, or if something happens and any number of things that could possibly happen, mm-hmm. That notification there is available. But also, it's just a very simple, secure way to stay in touch with your kid, and kind of a fun way to have your kid have a smartwatch without giving them access to the internet.
Mm-hmm. What do kids really like about it?
The biggest thing that my son likes about it is that it has very silly watch faces that have a bunch of different dinosaurs on them, mm-hmm. That it comes in a couple of fun colors, and that he can message me whenever he needs to for anything. Let me know that, that he needs to be picked up early, or that he's, staying late for a club or something, that he can do those things.
That's cool. They could do it right on the watch.
That's right. Yeah. And he can call me if he needs to. It's all, just kind of built right in without needing to be connected to a phone of his own.
Right. How much does this little dandy cost?
These are actually $150. Mm-hmm. And the mobile data connection that goes with it is $5 a month. So you can, you can do this, relatively inexpensively and have, this kind of peace of mind that comes with it, instead of needing to go out and buy a phone for someone that is, at least from my perspective, probably a little too young to have a phone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And it's affordable given that.
Right.
As an alternative. What about, is there any features on it to find it if the kid loses it?
Yes, there is a Find My Watch feature. It has a speaker built into it, and it will make a very high-pitched noise if you need to find it.
Okay.
And it's just a very simple app that lives on there. It also has because it has its own GPS features. If your kid accidentally leaves it at school or something like that, you can very easily pick it up on your phone and go, okay, so it's not actually here. I can stop looking.
Can you tell when the kid takes it off?
It doesn't have a skin sensor to let you know when the kid takes it off, but it does have a pedometer in it, so you can tell if the kid hasn't moved a whole lot for a little while, then there's a good chance that he has set it down.
Okay.
Or she has set it down.
Okay. Illustory Kids Bookmaking Kit. This is interesting.
I thought this was super cool and only kind of a gadget. The idea here is it is a self-contained kit for making your own book. It can be a comic book. It can be a story that you have creations to. But Lulu is actually a publishing company that works with Amazon. You can self-publish on Lulu and have things available to purchase on Amazon. And so you can actually take this and make it your own story and have it be, you can give your kid all of these tools to confine a story into a set number of pages and kind of organize it the way that either a comic book or a visual story would be, organized. And it gives you, simple frames to be able to put images in and help organize things a little bit and then make it so that if you wanted to, you could actually then send this to Lulu and have it printed.
Huh. Kids love to make their own books.
Absolutely. And every kid, has some kind of story that they would like to tell and loves the idea of having it organized in a book format. And to be able to actually put it together in a story that you could then, share with people, I think would be, is just generally speaking, a pretty powerful thing for most kids.
Is it software or is there more to it?
No, this is it's a cardboard box that shows up with markers. It's really not a gadget. I kind of lied.
Oh, okay.
But this is mostly a drawing thing. But when you are done with the book that you have drawn and created, you can actually then send it back to Lulu, and they will send you a higher quality printed version of the story.
Okay, I get it.
So
it's called Lulu Junior. So Lulu is the publishing that started for adults, and they moved to kids.
Right. That you as an adult can publish pretty much anything on Lulu and have it available on Amazon. And this is a kid's version of that, which gives them, storybook tools in the box that they can draw on and then send back to get a professionally printed, hard or soft cover book in response.
Are they used in schools?
I have not seen these used in schools around here, but they are, for $30 to get one of these sent to your house, it would be really easy to set up, for multiple people to be able to use.
And you can get those on Amazon or go right to Lulu?
You can do either. Yeah, they're available on Amazon for kind of prime next day delivery if you don't want to wait.
I wanted to ask you before I let you go, any surprises on Cyber Monday?
I think the biggest surprise for Cyber Monday was this really quirky thing that Amazon started doing through its Alexa stuff. There were several things that were available on really great deals, but in order to get them, you couldn't actually buy them from Amazon. Like, you couldn't go to Amazon.com and look for the thing and go to buy it. You actually had to say into your Amazon Echo that you wanted to order this thing, and by doing that, you then had access to this extremely interesting sale on whatever the thing was. So there was like an Echo plug. For example, they're normally $30 and you can get it for $5, but only if you asked your Amazon Echo to order it for you.
So they're trying to train us now.
Right. They're trying to train us to make those purchases. And I thought that was a very clever thing. I definitely did it more than once.
But you've been using Echo to buy things for a while now, haven't you?
I use it more as a shopping list. I like to, everyone in the house I've kind of successfully trained, when we're out of something in the house, they can say, hey, add this thing to the shopping list. And then when I get to the grocery store, I can look that thing up. But usually my phone is kind of on me already. So I'm usually, if I realize that there's something that I want to buy, I'll just grab my phone and do it instead of going through the Echo. But, being able to do it is pretty convenient.
Hmm. Well, Russell Holly, thanks a lot. What next week, what are we going to be talking about?
Next week, I think we're gonna cover that kind of middle school age range.
Okay. The middle school, the terrible middle school age range.
That's right.
Russell Holley, Android Central Contributing Editor, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for Tech Tuesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.